This programme is funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. I guess you could say I have the best of both worlds. I'm 25 and work in media along with living and working on the home farm. Agriculture and rural life has changed greatly over the years. It's changing right now. But how do we get to where we are? Join me, Marita Kelly, in this six-part series as I trace the key events that have altered the way we live and farm today and take a step back in time to see what it was really like in the Elfla's time. In this episode, I begin with looking at the changing face of Irish education and funding in agriculture. My first stop is Castlemarte, County Cork, to the home of J.J. Harty, the ex-president of Clonakilty Agricultural College, to see where it all started.
The whole concept was started back in the late 1800s. Then when the All Under Papa of Agriculture and Technical Instruction was started with a chap called Alice Plunkett. And he was the man with vision, if you like, to start up the County Commission of Agriculture. That was they started in 1904. And evolved out of that was the aspect that there would be demonstration farms or field stations, as they called them, in every province. That's how Clonakilty Agricultural College started. And there was a chap called O'Leary, had 350 acres. He donated that to the Monsignor Kelly, who was the local PP at the time, and who happened also to be on the National Committee of Agriculture. Now, that farm was to be for charitable and educational purposes. And it was established as a field station, and they set up a temporary building straight away into about 1903, and it opened in 1905. And that temporary building at that time was a galvanised shed, basically. And there was students came from all over the country, and you went home at Christmas, and when you came back at Christmas, you went home in the summer, and that was it. So that's how the agricultural colleges started, and side by side then with that, the whole issue of funding. And there were various acts in the 30s that gave the county committees the power to get so much on off the rates. And that's what funded the county committees to employ more advisors. That had a serious effect in the effectiveness of the advisory service in different counties, because we'd say if you take Cork, had a high rate. But if you were a county with a high rate and you were getting so much in the pound, you were getting a lot of money. Whereas if you had another county, it said the northern counties, where the rates were low, and if you're getting so much in the pound in that as well, you can see your income as a county committee would be much lower. So that led to, the southern counties being a bit more progressive in allowing them to employ more advisors.
And the agricultural colleges, do they branch out to specialise in specific areas?
Some of the agricultural colleges were state-owned, say, like Clonakilty and Kildalton, and the rest were owned by religious orders who started up as agricultural colleges, and then they became their own speciality, if you like. I mean, Penisginry does the exact same course as all the rest of the colleges, except it became a bit more specialised in machinery, the same as, say, Kildalton became specialised in horses and in horticulture.
And the agricultural organisations, how did they start?
You had Mokra, which was the start. That was in 1944, wasn't it? Then out of that became the IFA. And out of that, the IFA was in 1955. And out of that came the Farmers' Journal. And of course, the Farmers' Journal as a tool for training as well has been fantastic. I mean, that brought to the fore the problems in farming. It concentrated, if you like, the minds of the problems of farming. And they became the mouthpiece of the IFA, who were defending the issues of farming. And not alone that, but it became the technical document as well on a weekly basis.
It became
the Bible, and of course the IFA, which had its various presidents, which were top-class people that came through democracy, who trumpeted the problems of farmers and in terms of finding solutions down through the years in farmers, which is still going. It also not alone deals with local issues, but deals with worldwide issues as well, and has totally opened the scope of the thinking of the farming community.
And now they have, you know, the country living section, which is something for the house as well, maybe.
That's right, yeah. I mean, there probably is a big readership of non-farming people as well, because you're into the horticulture, into the beekeeping, and you're into the home living. as we started off about farming, it's not about dividing, you know, it encapsulates everything that happens out in the land and that everything that happens in the host, and everyone is relying on the other for success at the end of the day.
But the Agricultural Institute, how did that come about?
That came from opening up Johnstone Castle as the first lab, and that led to the Agricultural Institute, and of course Dr. Tom Welch, that he developed the Agricultural Institute, and the research and all its multifacets at the end of the day that was associated with farming. And the extension of that now is we're going into food safety, and a lot of programs are with the hospitals and with the universities. So tigers are playing a role there in terms of that you wouldn't have dreamt 5 or 6 years ago either.
When we joined the EC, what did that mean for Irish rural life?
The EC started in 1958, which was the six countries, and it took from that until 1973, where we were always interested before we finally got in. That took us out of the doldrums, if you like, of low-income farming, and it gave everyone an aspiration, I would say, to increase their output and increase their efficiency and everything else. And that happened from 1973 to 1977. And the big advantage of the EC was we were in recession in the 80s, like a European policy that brought interest rates down from 14, 15. I experienced interest rates at 21%. Now, they might be for a short time, but just imagine going out to buy the car or buy the house today at interest rates at 18, 19, 20%. But to bring that down to 5 or 6% was a huge advantage and led us to spending a lot more. That was one. And the control of inflation, of course, was the other one. That was awful important as well. And the introduction of the single farm payment.
When the county committees were disbanded, what happened then?
Like, up to the county committees of agriculture, well, you had 27 counties, Tipperary was two, and you had a CAO in each county who did their own programme, and the success of any programme within a county depended on the ability and the success of the CAO, whereas when ACAT took over, it put a national focus. It was way more efficient as well. That led to a greater degree of specialisation, and of course charging came in as well. Tagus itself then formed the integration of ACOT and research, which is the way it should have been. And of course, that led to a much closer relationship between the two bodies. It gave a much bigger realisation, number one, of research, and on the other hand, it gave much greater backup service to advisors as well.
How important was the actual Tagus advisor?
The role of the advisor, like that time, up to my first 15 or 20 years, you had to live where you worked. And that whole idea was that you were the guide, philosopher and friend of the farmer, being accepted as an advisor was a big part of the job. And if you were accepted, people had trust in you. So, like, if you were accepted at that level, you can, first of all, you found it much easier to get your message across. And number two, look at the help and support that you were able to give to that farmer about. And that is as true today as it was 20, 30 years ago. I mean, if you just think of yourself or anyone, I have a problem. Who can I ring up and be absolutely sure that they have a fair level of confidence to be able to deal with the problem I have, that it would be dealt in a confidential manner, and that hopefully at the end of that phone call, you walk out the back door feeling a bit better than what you walked in. I mean, the best farmers always were able to do that. No one except farmers themselves and those very closely associated with them have any kind of appreciation of the job of farming. You know, in terms of the competencies that you need to be a farmer, in terms of health, number one, right? I mean, the decisions that you must make on a 5-minute basis, like you must be a good stockman. You must be able to apply the science, which is the difference between a good farmer and a bad farmer is usually about 10 days or 40. You must be a vet. Now you must be an environmentalist as well, just to stay up with the kind of regulation that there is in farming and the whole pressure of even doing everything online. So there is no other job in the world that needs that range of competencies as farmers do. And that's the one of the most difficult parts of being an advisor, in that we all want the adoption of all the best practices. But like, when you look at what I talked about with the farmer, his family home is just inside the back door.
The door.
And there's as many problems in there as what there's outside. So like, if the child is sick and he's there all night and he's now outside in the yard making cows at 9:30 in the morning instead of 8 o'clock, you know, there's much to good in talking to that fella about what he's going to do about putting out the fertilizer after dinner, when it's you can talk to him as well about what's in his mind.
I hope to God he
hasn't
mastitis that morning.
That's the one they do have mastitis.
With the progression that we've made so far, JJ, what lies ahead for ag advisors with the changes that are taking place at the minute?
The research is there. We know how to do most of it. And to get that out there to the body of farmers is always a challenge.
I'm still keen to find out more about the ACOT education system that JJ mentioned. When that was in place, I wasn't even born then. So I drop into my neighbour's farm, Robert Collender, to see what it was really like to be a student back then.
The ACOT system was in the 1980s. I was student of the year in 1988. Instead of going to ag college, I did a course through ACOT, which is now TAGAS. It was the ag advisors that did it, and an education officer. The system I worked was, we went in for 2 days a week for 3 months of the year and went on for 3 years. So it was Tuesday and Thursday. And out of that, that gave us what was a green cert. What do we need a green cert for? When you went to go take over the home farm, you're entitled to a grant called an installation aid, and you needed to be qualified. So in order to do that, you had to do this thing called a green cert. Normally it was done in an ag college, but for people where it wasn't possible for them to go to ag college for different reasons, ACOT decided they'd run courses. So I did it in Dungarvan over the 3 years. And at the end of that year, then coming into the autumn, when we were going getting our certificates, that I was awarded student of the year. That was from 86 to 88. So I did. I got a small bursary. It wasn't like the Euro Millions or anything. And a plaque.
Was that based on your academic achievements then?
It was. It was based on, we did exams at the end of that, similar to what you do in ag college. And it was based on the results of them exams.
As part of the ACOT system, Rob, what did you actually do?
One day in the week, we did a farm visit, which was usually in the afternoon. And it was usually to local farms. We didn't really travel outside of maybe a little bit, 20-mile radius usually. And one day we may do a sheep farm. A lot of it was based on dairying, because the area is dairy-based, and a lot of the students that were with me were all dairy farmers. And so it was either sheep or dairying, really. And a lot of the dairy farmers at that stage would have had a beef enterprise.
Did you learn anything on those field trips, Rob, that you could implement at home?
Oh, you'd learn a lot. A lot of them, the farmers were brought to, actually were what you call host farmers, would have had students with them that would be training for the farm apprenticeship to go on as farm managers. So them farmers would know what a student would want to know when you're coming into them. Some of the students would be there as well, that they'd have, and they'd tell you their experience of what they found. And they were in a system whereby their farm was open anyway, so you came in and you could ask them about anything in their farm, and they were willing to tell you about it, and about their cows or their setup, and you could ask them about their milking or their feeding their cows or their animals, and they were quite willing to give you their knowledge.
TAGAS advisors played a significant role in agricultural education. So I've come to the Centre of Excellence in Moor Park in Fermoy, County Cork, to find out more from Regional Manager Gerard McMahon.
The advisors used to have classes in the winter where they'd meet the farmers. They didn't have to compete with the television, or maybe the radio was there, not at the same extent. And that was the winter work of the advisors, that they'd have 3 or 4 nights a week doing education courses. Advisors understand what's behind the figures. Our director of TAGAS is a Professor Jerry Boyle, And one of the things he says that in education, you're building capacity in people into adopt the technology. And that's what all the education that we did over the years was, helping people understand the principles so that they can adapt the technology for themselves. As advisors, you know, our job is to adapt the research work that's coming from down here, in, as you say, in the Centre of Excellence, where you have the leading research on grassland and dairy breeding is going on. We have to adapt that to suit the individual farmers, his level of risk, and what will work for him on his farm. Principles of good farming don't change.
And it's true, as Kevin Green saw in the ACOT days.
Myself and my brother Roger took part in the 180-hour course. We went on a few different excursions. We went up to Mellifont Abbey. We stayed overnight to see the milking setup down, to see the dairy farm. We went to Mellow Beet Factory. We went to Johnstown Castle. It was great, and it was very interesting.
What type of farming methods did you see when you went to Mellifont Abbey?
I saw specifically dairy farming. That was their enterprise. They seemed to be ahead of their time. That if they were doing what they were doing then, if they were doing it now, they'd still be up to date, like.
But Jared, how do we get to where we are today with the agricultural education system?
The best education farmers could get in the 50s and the early 60s, generally they spent a year in agricultural college. When I started there, even before I started, the main types of agricultural education was there. We mentioned the night classes, then there was winter farm schools. They were of 75-hour duration. And then after that, we came into the 100-hour EEC courses. And in those days, the farmers got a lunch out and they got paid a day allowance and a little bit of travelling for coming to the courses. They were subsidised under the EEC. They were in the 80s. They developed then on to becoming the certificate in farming, which was not 100 hours, it was 530 hours. And the last part of that was what we call the management module, where it dealt with the business and farming. Now, the agricultural colleges had to do that management module. There was two streams for the cert in farming. There was the college option, and there was the local option in centres like this, where we're sitting now in Fermoy. There would be a class going through of 20 to 30 people every 2 or 3 years.
This led to the HETEC 4-year Bachelor of Agricultural Science degree programme with the chance to study abroad, but also at secondary school level.
Well, agricultural science has always been on the second level schools, and it was quite a popular subject for people from a farming background who wanted to score higher points. Farmers always want to farm well. And the big thing now, the education, there's what we call ongoing education for farmers now. Big part of that is on the discussion group programme.
Tell us about the discussion group, Rob.
One time years ago, you had your egg advisor came out to you on 2 trips per year, maybe 3 trips in the year. And in recent years now, it's not possible for the egg advisors because in the first place, there's less of them, and then there's a lot more administration. It's all office work. Normally, to see your ag advisor, now you have to make an appointment to go to the office to meet him. So, in order to do this, a group of farmers got together. You went around every month to one of these farmers' farms, and you discussed what was relevant at the period, whether it was in the spring, whether it was calving, or grassland management. A lot of it was grassland management, which starts very early in the year. It starts in the early spring and goes on into the autumn. So you do grassland management in every trip, plus to whatever is relevant at the time of the year. There was a lot to be learned out of it, because you learn from other people's experience. It's one thing to see something written down or to hear someone tell you about something, but if you're from the fellow farmers who have gone through it, and they say, oh no, that doesn't work, oh, over the 3 years, you know, I learned a lot. I still learn a lot, and it is still ongoing, and we're still part of the same group. You learn something new every time.
Along with rural education changing, so did our funding structure. So, I'm at the office of Farm Accountant John Broderick. The Treaty of Rome, signed in 1957, established the Common Market. This defined the general objectives of the Common Agricultural Policy, or as we know it, CAP.
Yes, and at that stage we weren't a member of it, and like we were very much dependent on England for export of product. When we joined the EU, things really ratcheted up from a production point of view. The EU, I suppose, like if you want to describe the European Union, right, okay, it's a superpower, like America would be a superpower and like Russia would be a superpower. And one of the main principles of a superpower is that they want to kind of have security. And that security is not just kind of, let's say, in bygone years, it was military security was a major focus. But food security has become a major issue, we'll say. And the European Union took a policy to actually protect its citizens, right, okay, and provide, and the policy was to provide cheap food, in other words, to subsidize food. And as part of that subsidization, right, okay, the common agricultural policy, the first intervention, we'll say, of the EU, and the intervention policy was where they paid processors to store product up to a certain level, and then they released it on the world market. And in that era, we got kind of what was commonly known as the butter mountains, wine lakes, the olive lakes, where kind of product was stored and stored and stored. In an Irish context, we can recall it off Whitegate, and eventually they went to Russia and sold the butter at knockdown price. But that was a method of kind of, let's say, supporting the price of cheap food to kind of, let's say, each individual member.
And how did everyone feel about this policy?
There was a kind of a political uproar, if you want to tell me about that kind of policy. And that evolved then, we'll say, to the period of what they call direct payments. And the direct payments then, they actually kind of reflected all the way back to farmers. Grain growers got a subsidy per acre. Beef growers got a subsidy per 10-month and 22-month and slaughter premiums. And dairy was the only sector. A strong element of their support still went to the processor. So again, the money was going at farm level directly. And the principle then came about, what does the taxpayer get back? So this became unacceptable. And decoupling then was where the support went back to the farmer without any link to production. So that's where we are currently ending now. The single farm payment is a decoupled payment. You don't have to produce produce for it. As part of that decoupled payment, there was sister schemes such as the REP scheme, the disadvantaged area scheme, and they were kind of, let's say, payback to the taxpayer, where the taxpayer was seen to kind of relate to the fact that the rural economy was being preserved by the disadvantaged area payments and that the rural biodiversity was being enhanced by REPs payments. Now we're leaving that and we're going on to what's more termed a flat payment is the principle that was broadly outlined. And in this phase that we're entering into from 2015 onwards, some of the large decoupled payments that farmers have, the higher payments, farmers are going to take a cut there, and people that have low payments will get an increase. So the principle of convergence is what it would be termed.
Obviously, as a farmer, you are self-employed, so you must be thinking of the long-term future plan. How much of an influence did the retirement scheme have?
Well, the retirement scheme was an effort to bring mobility into land. There's a big consciousness of the age profile of farmers. So the retirement scheme operated where the normal retirement age would have been 65. So the EU brought in a scheme called the Scheme of Early Retirement, which meant that from the age of 55 onwards, you could retire from farming. And the principle there was, literally, that the retiring farmer could get out and enjoy maybe the latter part of his life. And a younger farmer, who was termed, I think the age profile was under 35 or 40, he got access into agriculture. And in an Irish context, it's very important because land mobility is extremely small. The percentage of land that actually moves in an Irish context relative to Europe is quite, quite small. There was no new bloodlines coming into farming. So that's really the principle that was behind the retirement scheme.
How was it funded?
The first round of it was entirely funded by the EU. The second phase of it then, it was jointly funded by the Irish government and the EU. And when that phase ended, which is circa, I'd say, from an entry point of view, it is over 10 years ago, actually, the last admissions to that scheme. There's been no retirement scheme since in an Irish context, or no scheme of early retirement. Your retirement now is purely at your own discretion.
So, in your opinion, what impact will Harvest 2020 have?
Well, Harvest 2020 is an aspiration where our agricultural output is looked to be kind of increased significantly. I suppose the big aspect of the Harvest 2020 would be the dairy sector in particular, because quotas are to be abolished from 2015. So again, they're looking here that our grassland base, our cheap system of production can be, if you want to use the term, milked. And they want the Irish milk production to kind of significantly increase by up to a factor of 50%. And I suppose the comparison here might be New Zealand. The New Zealand milk pool way back in the 70s and the Irish milk pool were very, very comparable. But New Zealand had a commercial advantage, a grassland system without quotas. And they've really, really kind of raced ahead in an international sense from a milk production point of view. So I think the real hope is, right, okay, in an Irish context, that we will stream on again now from a milk production point of view and maybe come up the rankings from a world perspective in the sense of production.
But with the imminent ending of the REP scheme, how are we fixed for the future?
When REPs closed, we had the EAS scheme. And the EAS scheme, I suppose, was kind of for making specific commitments in terms of hedge planting and tree planting, and you got rewarded per metre of hedge planting or per whip planted or whatever. But now the GLAS scheme is anticipated to be a merger of the two. But I think it'll be more on the lines of the EAS scheme, which I describe it as you'd have linear along a boundary, such as hedge planting and tree planting, fencing of watercourses. And then you'll have area-based commitments, such as leaving lands with low inputs for traditional hay meadows, or even lands with very little inputs and low stocking rates, such as species-rich grassland. We'll have areas left for kind of green cover. Those payments then will carry a per hectare payment, and the linear aspects will carry a per metre payment. So you have to spend here front-loaded normally to get the money. But it's capped for most farms at 5,000. There is a potential to get 2,000 additional money for extraordinary environmental contribution. And I think, again, the 5,000 won't even be kind of achieved by a lot of farmers. But the medium farms, or the median farms, I think, with little intrusion to their farming activities, could possibly access in the order of 3,500-4,000 euros from it. Which, again, it's a big loss relative to the 7,500 from REPS.
There is no doubt about it, but the face of Irish education and funding in agriculture has changed significantly. We're in a much stronger position with our education system, and funding, well, that continues to evolve. We'll have to wait and see where that one takes us. Join me in the next episode when I look at some of the key events that have changed the way we farm today. In the Elfless Time was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland with a television licence fee. Presented and produced by Marita Kelly and edited by Sean Healy. A Community Radio Yall production.